Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
My guest this evening is Donald Jeffries. Donald returns to discuss his upcoming book, Hidden History 2, Pre-1963 Corruption, Conspiracies, and Cover-Ups. His first nonfiction book, Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics, was released by Skyhorse Publishing in November 1914. Donald's soon-to-be-released book is Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Survival of the Richest scrutinizes how the collective wealth of Americans has been channeled from the poor and middle class into the hands of a few elitists. Donald Jeffries has been a JFK assassination researcher since the mid-1970s. His first novel, The Unreals, was published in 2007. Donald, how are you doing this evening?
Oh, fine. Thanks, Jim. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And you have, of course, your blog. What's your webpage again?
It's Keeping It Unreal, and it's donaldjeffries.wordpress.com.
Okay. Is there anything you want to add to that? Did I miss anything? Any major points?
No, I think you know you pretty much covered it. As for now, I have a lot of written material still backlogged, but that's all that's official right now.
Okay. Yeah, this book. you were kind enough to send me the manuscript.
Yeah.
And because of our technical difficulties last week when we did the original recording, I was able to read through a little bit more. So maybe that was a blessing.
Okay.
So we're back again trying to record our interview, trying to recreate the magic from last week. So this book, Hidden History 2, you get into, you know, the sort of the pre-JFK assassination stuff that Hidden History focused on, post-JFK stuff. Conspiracies and corruption and all that. So you talk about the founders, Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, and you get into Freemasonry and the founding. And Chris, how do you want to introduce the book?
Well, yeah, I mean it's basically a prequel to Hidden History. You know, taking a page out of Hollywood's book, and yeah, because a lot of people have told me, you know, this didn't start with the JFK assassination. Yeah, I know, obviously, but I started the Hidden History with the Kennedy assassination, just because for my generation. That was, you know, when things really started going downhill. I mean, I was, seven when he was assassinated. So that's, you know, I think it was the pivotal event of our generation. But obviously, there's been corruption for quite a long time. So I thought, well, there's certainly not to write about. You go back to the, I could have gone back to antiquity probably, you know, found some stuff. But just for the sake of, coherence, I decided to start it with, the American Revolution and the Founding Fathers and so forth. And as you mentioned, Thomas Jefferson is—he's one of my idols, and I think he's become one of the most denigrated figures in American public life now. And I think it's really a shame because he's the quintessential classical liberal, and he was one of the most brilliant men who ever lived. I mean, John F. Kennedy had that famous quip in the White House when he had a bunch of the greatest artists of his day at a White House dinner in, I think, 1962, and he said, "Gentlemen, this is the greatest collection of talent ever assembled in the White House under one roof, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone." And, that's what people thought of Jefferson, at least for a long time. So, some of the book is a defense of Jefferson, and it shows how a lot of the allegations against him are just ridiculous. And I try to contrast Jefferson with the treatment Alexander Hamilton has received. He was the banker's favorite founding father. He was the father of debt. And he's the only founding father that probably would fit in today. He'd probably be, you know, seated in the Council of Foreign Relations and probably would be a behind-the-scenes advisor to a lot of these politicians. But
that's right.
For some reason, he
called debt a blessing, didn't he?
Yeah. He's the one that, you know, and he, you know, if you study really the early political battles after the republic was founded, most of it boiled down to a battle between Jefferson and Hamilton behind the scenes, and because Jefferson wanted Jefferson, you know, didn't trust the bankers, and he wanted a limited government. And Alexander Hamilton, unfortunately, won out because he loved debt. He wanted a central bank, and he wanted consolidated central power. And if anyone can see, then, you know, what followed, Hamilton, the forces of Hamilton won, and he's the one that got to be a cool, hip, black guy on Broadway now, you know, with a hit Broadway show, and the rest of them are just dead white men, unfortunately.
Yeah, it was the Jefferson-Hamilton, I guess you could say those were the factions at the Constitutional Convention, although Jefferson wasn't there. I think he was our ambassador in Paris at the time during the Constitutional
right.
Convention. But the sort of the anti-Federalists versus the Federalists, the people who wanted Hamilton, I think, proposed the president could appoint the governors.
Yeah, and he wanted a more monarchy type of thing. Compared to a lot of politicians today, probably would sound pretty good. But compared to the rest of the founding fathers, I mean, they wanted limited powers, and people. Jefferson led the forces of people like Patrick Henry, who was older, but Patrick Henry was a real firebrand still. I mean, he's the one that didn't go to the Constitutional Convention because he smelled a rat in Philadelphia. that great line. And the original radicals, the Sons of Liberty, you know, Sam Adams and John Hancock. I mean, these guys were obviously on the side of Jefferson, but Alexander Hamilton, unfortunately, had a great influence over George Washington. He won out in Washington's first cabinet, and Washington ended up trusting him more than he should. I think he treated him like a son. But if the readers of Hidden History 2, when it's published, will see that I kind of wear my heart on my sleeve when I'm writing. It's pretty obvious that I consider Jefferson a hero, and I consider Alexander Hamilton an enemy of liberty.
And I think he had Washington's ear, which got his support, Washington's support for the first national bank, correct?
Right, much of the book details those battles because you had people, well, Hamilton behind the scenes and his forces, and then later leading up to Andrew Jackson, who led the battle against renewing the bank. And Andrew Jackson had some great lines about the bankers, and he was probably the second greatest foe of the bankers in the early days after Jefferson.
And it was the of course we had the Whiskey Rebellion, which was a response, which Hamilton supported a rather brutal suppression of, which Washington, to his credit, didn't do. But that was over the assumption, the federal assumption of debt, which was sort of one of the first corrupt bargains. It was a bond swindle because there was Hamilton's inside information knew that Congress was going to pay out those bonds in gold. And they went around the states buying up this paper, which people thought was worthless. And then they turned around and taxed those people to make good those bonds paid in gold. And that was one of the first, insider.
Well, I think Daniel Shays' rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion both. I mean, Shays and the other leaders of these rebellions were veterans of the Revolutionary War, and I think they felt a bit betrayed. And they didn't think that, especially under the Washington administration, they looked at it as perhaps they weren't, holding steadfast to the credos of the revolution. And I think that's was kind of a foretelling of things to come, that our leaders, even the best of them, didn't quite live up to their promises. And then when Jefferson came in, though, because after the Adams administration and the Alien and Sedition Acts, Jefferson came in. You know, and again, that would be revisited later. in World War One, you know, Woodrow Wilson locked up lots and lots of people, including Eugene Debs, a famous socialist leader. But these are the kind of, and, you know, this book, just like even more so than Hidden History, it relies more on exposing the lies of the established, what I call the court historians. The famous forgotten historian Harry Elmer Barnes was a guy, a great revisionist historian, who coined the term court historians, and I think it's perfect to describe the way professional historians are, tenured historians and professors of history. I mean, these are the guys you see on TV, like they're in that old Civil War series and things like that, that are, they just pontificate, and they're so full of themselves, and they're so cocksure, and they're usually spouting nonsense. You know, they're usually telling you deliberately distorted facts. And all of these things, if you just kind of chip away a little bit at the plaster, you expose so many lies about all these events. And I think, you know, going back to the founding, you just see how it becomes, the court historians simplify things so much that it becomes, you know, George Washington founded the Republic, and then later Abraham Lincoln saved the Union, and, you know, Franklin Roosevelt opened up the government to everyone, you know, and it's, maybe they'll throw in Rosa Parks, you know, refusing to get up on a bus and that kind of stuff. They'll throw a few more things in, but they just simplify it and dumb it down so much that it's no wonder that most Americans are historically illiterate.
They treat it like a fairy tale or a comic book, dumb everything down. That reminds me a few about, the 9/11 Commission actually released a comic book to explain the 9/11 events to the American people.
Yeah.
And Rachel Maddow was touting it. So this is what you should read to understand 9/11. Yeah, never mind.
Spider-Man round up all the conspiracy theorists before they can do any damage.
You know, but yeah, most people like a moralistic fairy tale to it, and
yeah,
sort of good versus bad. And
well, that's what it turns out to be. And it's these historians, again, they serve the same purpose, especially when you analyze these older events. Just looking at their books and the things they've said, and even now. People that, you know, you watch C-SPAN and things like that, where you listen to these professors, you know, talking about the books they've written, and it's just nonsense. They're just so inaccurate. It's just amazing, and I can't even watch it because I'm a real student of history, and I know, you know, history pretty well, and unfortunately these guys don't, or at least, but they think they do, and they're so, you know, what's the old thing about so, you know, so sure at the top of their lungs, and, you know, it was something like that, yelling the wrong thing at the top of their lungs or whatever, that kind of thing, where they're so loud in their assuredness about these things that are just totally contrary to the actual facts. When you just do a little investigating, whether it's the American Revolution or the Civil War or anything else that happened pre-1963.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also devote a lot of time to the issue of Freemasonry and its role in the founding, in the early part of this country. Of course, we had an anti-Masonic party, so people did take it very seriously at one point.
Right, and you can look. I have a whole, you know, lots and lots of quotes from John Quincy Adams, especially, who was a president of the United States, son of John Adams. Probably a better president than John Adams in my mind, but really brilliant man. You know, and he has some incredibly, you know, he sounds like the most diehard conspiracy theorist you ever heard. And this is the President of the United States talking about Freemasonry. And I think so many, the Freemasons have been suspect, and they were suspect at that time because of the secrecy and the oaths, the kind of frightening oaths. You know, the beginning of your oath for Freemason, it talks about tearing out, cutting your tongue out and throwing it in the tide at the low tide or something like that, if you dare reveal any of their secrets. And even if that's just completely symbolic, it scares people who aren't, you know, it scares me. I don't want to belong to any organization like that, because what if I get in and I don't like it? It's like, you know, and I see something I don't like, see something, say something, and then they tell us. and it's telling, you mentioned Bishop Albert Pike, you know, and later in recent times, I think it was the Mississippi legislature that voted to exhume the bodies of Nathan Bedford Forrest and his wife, just because, I guess, you know, they were Confederates, you know, and he was the original founder of the KKK, even though he later repudiated it. And I have all the quotes in the book where he actually became one of the original civil rights activists.
Mm-hmm.
But the professional historians don't talk about that. But Albert Pike, at the same time, was a virulent racist, was a leader in Freemasonry, but he was a, you know, went way beyond anything Nathan Bedford Forrest ever did. He has a statue still in Washington, D.C., and the same people that want to tear down monuments to people like Thomas Jefferson, nobody talks about tearing down Albert Pike, and that's because I believe he's protected by the fact he was one of the most powerful Masons who ever lived. And I think that's the only rationale that explains it.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, what that does, that goes back to that simplistic interpretation of history, where Nathan Bedford Forrest, I think, because he was, you know, he founded the Ku Klux Klan, but it doesn't get into why the Ku Klux Klan was founded in the first place. Of course, that opens up a can of worms with Reconstruction and the American Civil War, so called. And you devote a lot of time to shattering the icon of Abraham Lincoln and addressing the issues of the war between states, how this was a unnecessary, a very completely unavoidable war. I mean, completely avoidable war. And the viciousness in which the North prosecuted its war to conquer the South.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many important things about the Civil War, and there are none of the important things that the court historians will tell you about. I mean, they're Abraham Lincoln is really probably a fitting symbol because he's basically he's our cultural saint, you know. At this point, he is the face of our civilization. As Thomas DiLorenzo, who I owe a great deal to, I mean, I relied a lot on his research for this. He really was a pathfinder in it. I wrote Lincoln Unmasked, and I believe another book about Lincoln. But
he also has one on Hamilton too. Hamilton's Curse was pretty
good. Yes. He wrote a great book. He and I agree. We don't agree on everything. I don't think he would like my views on trade mechanism. But he and I definitely agree on Jefferson versus Hamilton, and certainly on Lincoln. But Lincoln is revered like no other figure ever has been, and as DiLorenzo has found out, trying to go up against these guys, he calls them the Lincoln cult, and they are. And he said that, you know, it's necessary to make excuses for Lincoln over and over again because this is a guy who I think it was Donald Herbert Donald or something. He's a big establishment historian. He even admitted, and I use one of his quotes as an epigraph at the beginning of the chapter, that it would be hard to conceive of what Lincoln thought was the end of his powers. I mean, he thought his powers extended indefinitely. He thought he could do whatever he wanted. He tried to arrest the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, for instance. And his men had to hold him back. And they said, well, you know, that's going a little too far because the Chief Justice had the audacity to rule very, very correctly that his suspension of the writ of habeas corpus was unconstitutional. We still don't know how many people Lincoln threw in jail. Without trial, without charges, he just rounded them up. And lots of these people, including one of my heroes, Congressman Clement Vallandigham, was arrested in the middle of the night. I mean, literally had troops banging on them. Just imagine what kind of a terroristic state you're living in when troops can knock on your door in the middle of the night and just take you from your home and family and just throw you in a makeshift prison. You have no attorney, no charges are filed against you. You have no idea when you're going to get out. Conditions are reprehensible. And we don't know how many thousands of people were thrown into jail over the most trivial things. I mean, some citizen would talk about see something, say something. So one of the things, I think a guy, some of the kids were, they were waving a flag with blackberry juice on it or something. Somehow that was considered that they were being disrespectful to the Union or sympathetic to the Confederates, and the dad went to jail for months. Or one of these crazy jails. You know, he certainly didn't legally, you know, go through any kind of justice. But I think that's what first left. So even outside of the war, the prosecution of the war, just Lincoln on the issue of civil liberties alone, is just like no other president we've ever had. I mean, he was to say that he was a tyrant is to put things mildly. And the prosecution of the war, obviously, you talk about total war. Total war was invented under Union generals like Sherman and Sheridan. I mean, these are the first people that we know of in the history of warfare that decided that women and children, crops, food, horses, so forth, were fair game. Property, personal property. I have a letter in there, quotes from a letter from a Union soldier who was talking about the entire system they had of theft, where they would go and they would rob the Southern families of everything they had and how they would dole out the booty and how Sherman got a cut of everything. Like the top gangster leader. And these are heroes. You know, these are the people we're told were the heroes. And if you study the South, and again, the only reason the Confederacy isn't seen in retrospect as a lovable underdog, and actually it was for a long time, even you go back even 50 years ago, you know, it the South was portrayed differently than it can be now. The lost cause and all that kind of stuff, there was a romanticism about it. But because of slavery, again, that single issue alone, if you take slavery out of the equation, there's no question who were the good guys and the bad guys here. You had a much smaller group that wanted to, you know, break away from the Union, much as the Americans in 1776 wanted to break away from the colonies, wanted to break away from Great Britain. And the idea that Americans can't see the hypocrisy there, that here you had Abraham Lincoln and the radical Republicans of the day that just put the full force of a federal army behind keeping these people, you know, they talk about consent of the governed. They clearly did not consent to be governed, but they turned the issue later. It wasn't about slavery at all at first. Lincoln never mentioned the word slavery in his first national address to Congress. It was only a year or two into the war, then Lincoln thought for political expediency that he would start acting as if this was a noble effort on the part of the Union. And you can look at the letters home, you can look at a testament from Grant and everybody else. These guys were just as racist as the Southerners were. Virtually all white people were racist then, especially considered in today's terms.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not fighting for Lincoln's own. I mean, Lincoln has statements on the record that read like anything that any grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan ever said. So here you had an avowed white supremacist, which almost every white leader back then was, who was trying to say that later, in retrospect, that he was fighting to end slavery. And then, of course, near the end of the war, then, again, Lincoln, the record shows he probably was an atheist, but he turned it into this spiritual battle where he was basically saying God was responsible for the Civil War, that the bloodshed was because God was, you know, tired of this awful slavery and that America was being punished for it. So it's, but however you look at it, between 600 and some people think now as many as 800,000 Americans, most of them very, very young. I mean, I think one quarter of the males in the South were wiped out. I mean, it was a genocide, really. I mean, it was awful to say they were a lost generation. But to think that this was a good war in any way, shape, or form, because slavery eventually was eradicated because of it, slavery would have ended there like it did all around the world. But and somehow Americans have been conditioned to say, well, these terrible Southerners, when, you know, only 4 to 5% of Southerners own slaves. So and certainly anyone fighting pretty much did not own slaves. All those young Southern boys were not slave owners. Most of them were poor because they had the $300 rich man's exemption. Back then, no rich men fought. If you had $300, you paid it to, which is a fortune then to poor families. You paid it, and they sent their boy off to war, go to war. You know, we can use this money. And so that's who did the dying were poor people. And Lincoln's own son, Robert Todd Lincoln, and he came under a lot of fire for it. He was certainly of prime age, and he stayed safely at Harvard. And until finally at the end of the war, Lincoln sent him to some very cushy position on General Grant's staff where he was in no chance. He was in no danger of ever even seeing any gunfire whatsoever.
And, well, also, with the issue of slavery, is Lincoln himself endorsed the original 13th Amendment, the Corn Amendment, which would have preserved slavery in perpetuity, putting it beyond all challenge if the South agreed to stay within the Union.
Yeah, and I believe that's the one that Lincoln court historian and former LBJ mistress Doris Kearns Goodwin. she's one of the great court historians, let me tell you. Another Oswald did it, you know. I mean, just yeah. Straight down the line. I believe she's the one that tried to praise that and saying that was a great act of political something. So I forget how she phrased it. I have it in the book.
Pragmatism?
Probably pragmatism, something like that. But that would be a word to describe it anyhow. But yeah, man, that's the thing. Like Tom DeLorenzo said, they have an excuse for everything Lincoln ever did. I mean, the guy, anyone who looks at what he said. I mean, I have a quote in there. Again, these are right from the people, General Sherman himself. You know, the monster of all the Union generals who did the most damage of all during that ridiculous march to the sea when he was, you know, talk about, and that's the thing about, you study, I despise war, so I know nothing really about war, military tactics or strategy. But it doesn't take much to realize that the Stonewall Jackson was a brilliant strategist. Robert E. Lee, Johnston, a lot of these other, Jeb Stuart, were actually really good military tacticians. That's why the South stayed in it so long, because they were so outnumbered. But the Northerners' entire strategy boiled down to a war by attrition. They had more numbers, and so the idea was to just barge in, and that's why General McClellan ran into such opposition from Lincoln and the public, because he didn't want to just go, you know, barge in like that and just overpower the enemy, because he knew that it would result in tremendous casualties. He didn't want to risk his men's lives unnecessarily, but Lincoln kept, you know, Lincoln just denigrated him, and just much like today, the media would denigrate somebody by saying he's got a case of the slows, you know, and that's basically how history remembers him, that he had a case of the slows, and he's basically remembered as a wimp that wouldn't fight. When if you read what he wrote, as opposed to what Lincoln and Sherman and Sheridan wrote and did, I think he stands up a lot better than they did, and you certainly look at Grant had no military ability at all. Even Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, had a quote about calling him, I forget what his nickname was, what was his name? Grant had a denigrating nickname, and it was basically based on the fact that he was getting so many men killed, because that was his strategy. And even Lincoln's wife said that Grant, you know, constantly getting his men killed unnecessarily, and Grant admitted several times, hey, we have more men, that's how we're going to win. It was just an awful strategy. But Sherman, by the time he marched to the sea and burned Atlanta and all that, there was virtually no one in his path. The scattered troops were elsewhere. They couldn't. He basically, you know, overpowered. I mean, it was pretty much like the first Gulf War. You know, we basically sent Mike Tyson and a bunch of professional boxers over to fight some kindergartners. You know, that was basically what it was like. And in this case, that's what it was like for Sherman. He basically encountered nothing except for starving and destitute women and children, whom his troops, raped with impunity, especially the slave women. Which is, again, you want to look at the raping that occurred. I mean, I have lots of it in the book, account after account of Union troops taking liberties with the slave women and actually killing some of the slave men who tried to defend their honor. But again, these are the great, and this, what this had to do with the war, I don't know. But this, again, this total war concept was, hey, the booty is all ours. Literally, the booty in that case, you know, whether it's raping, pillaging, burning crops. I mean, they would salt land so that even after they left, they couldn't plant anything else again. I mean, this awful, atrocious stuff that they did, and these are war crimes if there ever was such a thing as a war crime. And the idea that these guys had a chance, and later we would see this revisited in Nuremberg, where they were the ones that first invented the concept of legally punishing by trial the loser of a war, and they did that with Captain Wirtz, who was the commandant of Andersonville Prison, which was, and again, in the court historian's mind, people think, oh, Andersonville, such atrocities happened there. Well, the South, again, they didn't have foodstuff for their troops. They were stealing and taking food, the Northern troops were, from the civilians. How were they possibly supposed to come up with enough food to feed the Northern prisoners, who they kept trying to trade? And again, Grant and Lincoln, and everybody, they would not trade prisoner for prisoner. And then eventually the South got so desperate, because they had some compassion, unlike the North, and they said, we can't feed these men. They're starving to death. So they wanted to release their prisoners without even getting Southern prisoners in return, and the North still wouldn't do that. And for that, Wirtz was the guy. Wirtz had a force of people take some. They actually took the Northern prisoners and tried to drop it off at a point in Florida. I have the account in the book, and they were turned away by Grant's troops, told to go back. And this guy is considered a war criminal by the court historians, again, because they don't read history accurately and they have an agenda. And Wirtz was hung after the war for war crimes. And this is the first time you go back to, I think it was Charles I or something, during the English Civil War, who was charged after, but he was charged with treason. That's what was kind of a traditional reason, for, you know, traditional charge against leaders. Not war crimes. It took the North under Lincoln and under the Radical Republicans to come up with this concept of war crimes, and he was executed. And then later, of course, after World War II, the concept of war crimes really took off, and now it's just accepted that after you defeat an enemy, you know, it's okay to, you know, to execute them legally or put them in jail and punish them further. And again, it goes against all of recorded history to treat defeated foes that way. There used to be some kind of gallantry and honor there, but Lincoln set a precedent. Lincoln's, the Northern troops set some so many awful precedents that we never recovered from.
Of course, the war criminals are always the losers.
Right, history is... Yeah, that's exactly. That's, just imagine what history would have... I can't even imagine how different history would have been if the South had won, but obviously Lincoln would probably be considered... He would be like Hitler. He would be, you know, the greatest criminal in our history instead of the greatest hero. And it's always, you know, one of my favorite, you know, lines that we've heard many times before is history is written by the victors. A lot of, at the beginning of the book, I have lots of quotes from people, you know, that talk about, to that effect. I mean, yeah. Very distinguished people realize that, hey, after this happens, we're going to be given our side of the story. We're not given, you're not going to hear the defeated here. You know, after World War II, certainly not going to hear the German side and the Japanese side or the Italian side. You're just not going to do that. You're not going to really know what the Soviet side during the Cold War. So it's always going to be whoever won. They're going to write the history, and they're going to make the hero. They're going to decide who the heroes were and who the villains were. And it's they're usually cardboard character villains. I mean, the Hitler types that are impossibly evil, impossibly inhuman. Just there's just no way to even understand them as flesh and blood creatures, but. That's what we get. And later, you know, you end up getting, you know, like bad sci-fi movies like They Saved Hitler's Brain and Hitler, you know, the Nazis turning into zombies and stuff. And people, they kind of nod their head. Yeah, I mean, you can't imagine G.I. Joe turning into a zombie.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what the book is really an effort, you know, in many ways to try to just tear the veneer off of all these events. And I definitely spent a lot of time talking about Lincoln in the Civil War, because I feel so strongly about it, and the idea that Lincoln, I went off the track there, but my original point about that was when even Sherman himself acknowledged, after he committed all these atrocities in the South, and all the awful things, you know, burning houses and destroying, you know, bragging about all the chimneys left without the houses and that kind of thing, which he would brag about, and when he went to the White House afterwards. And he recounted how Lincoln wanted to hear all the atrocities in detail and laughed uproariously as he described what he was doing to the women and children. So this is the kind of man who is the most heroic figure, according to the court historians, that we've ever produced. And unfortunately, he just wasn't, and his death had a lot to do with that, the way he died. And, of course, I have a whole chapter devoted to that, too. It's very much... really incredible that at the same time this figure cannot be criticized and he is revered beyond any other, they've never told the truth about his assassination. They continue to lie about it and pretend that it was this random act by this Southern sympathy. And the work of Dave McGowan in this regard has been really great, the late Dave McGowan. I don't know if you can even find it online anymore, but...
They're putting it into a book, I think. A lot of that stuff, I think.
Yeah, his daughter, I think, is trying to do that, but
yeah.
Really, really great stuff, because he's the one that really made me first start thinking about the fact that if this was connected to the South, why, you know, everyone in that little plot, that other than Lewis Payne, was the only one who could be called a Southerner in any sense of the word. All the rest were Northerners. You know, they all came from Northern families, and it's like, why would they get together in some kind of Confederate plot? So, again, if you look at it, there's so many... so many questions there that haven't been answered, down to the fact of what happened to Booth and who's buried in Booth's grave. And I go into that in detail. I talked to Booth had no legitimate biological children, although he may have had children out of wedlock because he was quite the womanizer. But I talked to his great-great-great-great-whatever grandniece, and she has been leading the effort for years to try to get the body in Greenmount Cemetery in Maryland exhumed, because lots of people don't believe that John Wilkes Booth is there. They believe the person that died in the barn was someone else, and that Booth went on to escape and live decades later. But this is how powerful these incidents are, and that's why it's important for us to continue to study history, because you see that even, you know, 150 years later, it's so important for these court historians to maintain these false narratives that they can't take a chance on that. I think they pretty much in the back of their minds know that it's not Booth there. But what happens if they go and they've had the DNA test and they find it's not Booth? Well, all those, you know, for decades, all the people that poo-pooed the finest Bates and people like that wrote the original stories about it, that denigrated them. All the court historians that won Pulitzer Prize and stuff that said this is ridiculous, there's no controversy at all, suddenly they have egg on their faces and they just won't allow that. No matter how old the event is, they won't allow it. And it's not gonna, and that's why you see it being blocked, because you look at if you call anybody or check into it about, you know, what is the process for exhumation? If you want to exhume a body, the family has the last say everywhere, at all times. If a family wants to do it, you know, to have it done for any kind of legitimate reason, then it's up to them. They can block it. In this case, the family has wanted to have it done, and it's blocked by government. And the same thing goes even farther back to Meriwether Lewis. Why go into that a little bit? I talked to his, again, he had no biological children, his great-great-great-great-great-great-grand-nephew or something. Very nice gentleman. And again, he's been trying for a long time because they believe that he didn't kill himself, that he was murdered, and I pretty much concur with that. And they, again, they're being blocked. The family wants it done, but the court historians have too much invested in these narratives, and so they won't allow it to happen. And that's what we find over and over again. The court historians on these subjects act just like the mainstream media does today. You know, it's the exact same kind of thing. They're the voices of the state. You know, online it's Snopes.com, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. These are, you know, there's always these official, they come up and tell you how, well, technically, you know, you're wrong. You know, this is not the way it works. And, you know, we don't need to exhume that body to know that. We just know. And it's crazy. We're not going to dignify that with a response.
What's that? Skeptics.com. Shermer is the most gullible skeptic I've ever met in my life.
Oh God, yeah.
Shermer.
Yeah, they're awful. I mean, the only thing they're skeptical about are the skeptics. I mean,
yeah,
skepticism at all. They question the questioners, and that's what all these guys do. Skeptic magazine or any of these things. They completely trust in what the authorities are telling them. Nothing to see here. Move along. I mean, that's their credo. And in all of these things, they just look at it like, no, we've built up the narrative. Abraham Lincoln was a great man, you know. And
he's in a Greek temple in D.C. and he's 30 feet tall.
Yeah,
so
exactly. You know. I mean, I have all the quotes and I have a. I mean, these reporters. I mean, they literally. It is a Lincoln cult, like Thomas DiLorenzo has pretty much acknowledged it. It's like a religion. These people worship Lincoln and. I understand that, you know, we all need heroes, but in this case, if you want to look at American history, people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were truly heroic. Patrick Henry, most of the founding fathers were, the exception of like Hamilton.
Yeah, but their utterances, their sayings, and their philosophies are an affront to the current dispensation of American politics.
Exactly, and that's what happens. That's why I wrote an article on my blog about this, and I mentioned it repeatedly, is that you look back at the history of Hollywood, the history of popular culture. Hollywood has always hated the Founding Fathers. Even in the early, you know, even back in the 30s and 40s when we were making lots of patriotic movies, there was never in the Golden Age of Hollywood a biography about George Washington, about Patrick Henry, about Thomas Jefferson, about Benjamin Franklin. That Hamilton did. They did have one about Hamilton. Even then, they recognized Hamilton was different. And they realized they could talk about it. Because, again, the rest of them, their entire lives are talking about liberty, about the government oppressing them. I mean, read the Declaration of Independence and all the usurpations and an endless series of crimes against the people. I mean, these are what those of us that aren't asleep know are going on today and have been going on for a long time, and far worse than anything that was going on under King George. You know, the far-flung shores of England, there was nothing. I mean, you know, a Stamp Act and a Tea Act and things like that compared to what we've been, the kind of, corruption, the nonstop corruption we've been living under during my lifetime, anyhow.
We've exchanged for having a tyrant one tyrant 5,000 miles away to having 5,000 tyrants 1 mile away, so...
That's exactly what it is.
It's a trade-off.
Yeah, quite a trade-off. I don't know which. I think I can figure out which one is more preferable. But that's so they can't. They prefer to. They just simply. That's when Mel Gibson made the movie The Patriot in the late 1990s. He caught so much flack because, again, that's when I really started to say, "Hey, Mel Gibson is different." You know, because he was talking about a forbidden subject. He was showing it from a patriotic American standpoint. That, you know, he showed the British as being, you know, probably almost cartoonishly evil, but still, yeah. He was showing the notion that the movement for independence and liberty and, you know, wanting to rule ourselves was a good thing, and they just can't have that. Our leaders can't have that because people might start getting ideas. Well, you know, consent of the governed, you know, the people should rule. You know, how does that possibly stand up against hate speech and hate crimes and free speech zones and security cameras everywhere and drones? You know, it just doesn't. They don't go together. You know.
Yeah, even in that movie, The Patriot, when they're talking about declaring independence, and he's speaking in the state legislature, and at this point, he's a veteran of the French and Indian War, mm-hmm. and he reminds them he's hesitant about going to. Independence and fighting war, and he reminds the people of what war is.
Yeah,
and he says you may not want this. And I thought that was a good part. That was an interesting scene in that movie where before you take this decision, it's a very heavy decision. I've seen war close up. I know what it's like. Do you want your farms burned, your families killed? And that's what I guess in that movie, in that particular portrayal, that's what drives him to fight. Is I believe he is assaulted by British soldiers. That's what. When his family is attacked, but you, of course, you alluded to Abraham Lincoln's assassination, and you mentioned the conspiracy there. And in the piece in your book, you mentioned, of course, the trial of Mary Surratt, the illegal military tribunal, the treatment of the prisoners themselves by Stanton, which was abhorrent. There's some question of what he belonged. I believe Booth, of course. Booth is a relative of Claire Booth Luce, Luce's wife, and also to Tony Blair's wife, right? Sherry Blair.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle, this pre-Masonic.
Yeah, I believe you run into these kind of strange connections everywhere. Yeah. Booth is Terry Alford, who's an establishment historian, but he said that Booth would think of Brad Pitt. That, you know, he was that level of fame and notoriety. So Booth, this was not. I mean, just imagine today if Brad Pitt assassinated the president. I mean, it's that kind of that's kind of celebrity. Yeah. So he wasn't this crazed loner. He was a very, very famous celebrity, and for him to do something like that, and then of course his diary is lost and it's missing pages. Just right at the appropriate time, right before and after the assassination. So these are the kind of things, if you've studied as many of these cases that I have and you probably have, and you're accustomed to knowing it, well, that doesn't even surprise you. Of course those pages would be missing, Why would they be there, And that's what we come to expect. But as you mentioned about Stanton, and a lot of people have, and I am one of them, Otto Eisenschimmel, who is certainly not a court historian, he wrote... some of the first couple books that really questioned the official story of the Lincoln assassination back in the 20s and 30s, and he speculated that he thought Stanton was behind it, was the Secretary of War, Edmund Stanton, and his behavior certainly suggests that. He basically took over, and their trial, again, they had hung Captain Wirtz, the commandant, as I said, as a war crime, and they basically, that kind of fervor basically carried over into the trial of the so-called assassins and of the conspirators, and they say you have to read. I have it all in the book there. I mean, they were just treated horribly. They had these heavy masks put over their face, where they couldn't even see out. They had small holes, slits for breathing. They were kept in cells with an empty cell between them. They were kept shackled. Only Mary Surratt, because she was a middle-aged woman, was spared that. But Mrs. Surratt was the last woman hung in American history, I believe. And, there's no evidence at all against, really there's very little evidence against any of the so-called conspirators that would stand up in a true court. But this wasn't a court. This is a military tribunal. And, again, they really didn't have much of a defense. They weren't permitted much of a defense. And readers will be able to see for themselves the kind of testimony that sunk them and the evidence that sunk them that it's really just another. There's so many dark chapters on our history, but that was just particularly bad, especially when Mrs. Surratt was hung like that, because if she was guilty of anything, it was just she rented a room to John Wilkes Booth. That was it, and somehow on that, well, she rented the room where the plot was hatched. It's like, okay, well, I don't think you really proved much about the plot, but evidence is not wanted in these cases. Emotion ruled the day, and much as after Oswald was killed at the JFK assassination, they had to blame someone, and they couldn't look for the real assassins, since they were pretty much sponsoring it. They had to tab someone, and then Oswald was the scapegoat there. And in the case of the Lincoln assassination, I mean, I don't think anybody doubts that John Wilkes Booth pulled the trigger, but the rest of the so-called conspirators is very dubious evidence of it. And actually, probably the most likely co-conspirator was John Surratt, who was Mary Surratt's son. He escaped, later worked in the Vatican Guard. He was very open about it. And he came back later as a so-called fugitive from justice, and he ended up being, he was really not punished at all, and ended up being a noted lecturer on the Lincoln assassination, of all things. And he's kind of not someone I could admire. I mean, he didn't even come back to try to, I think he might have been able to spare his mother's life if he had come back, but he didn't, and let her be hung. So, but that's what happens in these cases. Really, there's somebody who might have known something about it, escaped justice, and then later became a lecturer, lecturing about the false official narrative.
Now, you also have devote a good deal of to the era of Reconstruction and the corruption and how it led to the era of Jim Crow. And a lot of us think of the South before the 1960s as being this area of sort of horribly racist, backwater, ignorant. None of us, very few, look at the conditions in the South, perhaps in the early 20th century, as a consequence of this horrible war that Lincoln waged. So we look at Reconstruction as the North coming in and occupying this benighted region of the country and sort of bringing in enlightenment and modernizing and reforming the laws and protecting blacks. And the true history is something very different, as you write.
Yeah, I mean, it was, just logistically. I mean, just if you just look at what physically happened to the South, and how many houses were burned, how many crops were destroyed, how many people, how many men especially died. I mean, they had such a surplus of females, you can't even imagine, because like I said, one quarter of the males in the South died. So after the Reconstruction, even if the North hadn't come down so heavy-handed, I mean, one of the things we can say about Lincoln is apparently his policy towards the South would have been a lot softer and a lot more conciliatory than the radical Republicans wanted. So once he was out of the way, and that goes into one of the theories, that he was killed by the radical Republicans who thought he was going to be too soft on the South.
This was his malice towards none approach?
Yeah, exactly, malice towards none. If he really was going to do that, then clearly that was going against what the wishes of the radical Republicans, the people who had really pushed for the war so strongly. But just logistically, the South was just completely devastated. And unlike the Marshall Plan that we would see after World War II, it wasn't like the government was going to go in and just pay for some massive. The Reconstruction wasn't a building Reconstruction. The Reconstruction was they wanted to have a political Reconstruction, and it was all built around we're going to get these people to understand that everyone's created equal and that you're not going to rebel against the government anymore. We put you down once, and we showed you who was boss. And clearly, these Southerners, the ones that were left, had so much pride, and they remembered all the atrocities they committed. So when you suddenly had former slaves sitting in Congress who were illiterate, literally couldn't read or write, and that's no denigration to them. I mean, we all know that slaves, for the most part, weren't allowed to learn to read or write. So they couldn't – it's just a reality. And to have people who couldn't read or write and had no knowledge of the workings of government sitting, lording it over the people who had been their literal former masters in many cases, that must have stung Southern pride like, like nothing. And, of course, the empty promise of 40 acres and a mule, where they promised the slaves all these things, and they basically incited them, that's yours. The women are yours. The mansions are yours. You know, this all belongs to you now. We won. So how much of that they took to heart, I don't know. But I do know that, you know, from looking at the other side of the record, that lots of bad things were happening to the Southerners that were left. And the Ku Klux Klan was basically formed initially, out of as a protective measure, basically. I'm sure you know that, or Nathan Bedford Forrest and Robert E. Lee knew about it, and all the leaders, they expressly forbid violence. They were basically trying to scare the slaves back into submission. That's why they wore white sheets. They were trying to be ghosts, I think, originally. But whatever happened, it apparently worked, because at least as far as the Southerners were concerned. And then the crackdown against the blacks began, and we saw basically after that you saw the Jim Crow laws, the separate but equal, and the real racism was born. And there's no evidence other than people accepting the reality of slavery, which was normal. I mean, in our eyes now, it's just hard to understand, reprehensible, that slavery could ever be normal anywhere, but it wasn't. And unfortunately, I guess it's for the 30 million slaves that are around the world today, it's apparently still normal, and no one seems to care about that we still have slavery. In India alone has 10 million slaves, but no embargoes of them, apparently, for some reason. But after the South was able to turn things around with their own counterterrorism, I guess you'd call it, or terrorism, how you want to look at it. But then the backlash began, and these really awful things like Jim Crow laws and separate but equal and the apartheid system that existed in the South for almost a century, and like Langston Hughes would later say, it was bound to explode. And everybody knew that was going to happen. And really it all, in my mind, it all came about because of the way America got rid of slavery, the violent way they did it, and the
violence begets violence. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And you just no other in every other part of the world, nobody else fought a war over this. Slaves. Eventually, it got to the point where people saw. I mean, America would see. Okay, slavery really doesn't exist anymore. All the countries are, and people don't realize Virginia, the cradle of the Confederacy, they had voted to stop the importation of slaves. I think they barely voted to pass that in their legislature right before the beginning of the Civil War. So the South recognized it. And people like Jefferson, who's criticized constantly because he didn't free his slaves at his death, he wanted a gradual emancipation, and he had delineated a gradual emancipation plan where eventually by a certain point any slave born would be born free. But he recognized that you couldn't turn people out who had been literal property, who'd been considered subhuman, not been allowed to read or write. You couldn't turn them out into society suddenly and expect them to, first of all, to be accepted as equals by all the people who saw them as property, and also the fact that they couldn't possibly function because they had no training other than as being used as a human channel. Yet they, the Lincolns of the world expected this miraculously, everyone to start singing "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot" together or something. I don't know what they were picturing, but what happened was predictable to anyone that had any foresight. And Jefferson had seen ahead, and he had a plan that made sense. It was a gradual emancipation, and that's what should have occurred, I believe. But instead, we had this century of really awful, where you could probably make the claim that more blacks suffered under Jim Crow than they had under slavery. And
during the Great Depression, the Roosevelt administration, one of its programs was commission some reporters to go down south and interview some surviving slaves. They're in their obviously very elderly at that point, but they want to get their reflections on what was life was like and before the war. And what they expected would be that we're free now, it's great, that North freed us. They got the exact opposite. It's called the slave narratives.
Yeah.
And what you get is people, now a lot of this can be attributed to the fact that they're obviously remember when they were young, and all of us look at life better when we're younger because they're young.
Right.
We're not old.
Right.
So you have to discount that somewhat, but they were shocked that they looked at the days before the war, the antebellum South, as the good old days.
Right. Right.
And there are some studies about the living standards of slaves compared to the wage slaves of the North.
Exactly. And,
yeah.
and actually, the
life expectancy was higher for the slave in the South than it was for a worker in the North.
Right. And the idea that it was just the South, it was, like I said, if you look at Grant, Sherman, Lincoln, all these, none of the... It's not like the North was a bastion of tolerance and love everybody's equal, all men are created. They did not think that at all. They all believed that blacks were inferior. They treated them as such. They just didn't have plantations in the North.
Yeah.
For the South, that was a way of doing business. And, again, we can't understand that today. And the problem is talking about these things, and I'm sure I'll come under fire, I want to go on the record that I'm not defending slavery, which is why I'm upset about the 30 million slaves in the world today that no one else seems to care about.
Yeah, but you want to get the most accurate portrayal as possible of how
right,
it works.
And exactly, yeah. And these are because of the way it's portrayed. We look at it through a prism of today's society, and therefore we continue to make Hollywood continues to make ridiculous movies where these slobbering tobacco spitting, absurd racists that are lusting over all the black women and wanting to beat the black men all the time and calling them boy and the N-word constantly and just vicious, absurd. I'm sure, obviously, there were bad people that probably, acted like that then, but I don't think that's, really a realistic. And what purpose does it serve? And I think at this point, I think it keeps black people thinking about that period instead of realizing, okay, that was an awful period in our ancestors' history, but at some point we have to move beyond it, and everybody has to try to get along. And what happens when you keep dredging that stuff up? That's why, especially when you do it in an inaccurate way, mm-hmm. When you act like this was, Massa Lincoln was this great guy who was just a great emancipator, and the record simply doesn't show that. It shows that he was a white supremacist, pretty much like most of the white guys in that day. And virtually every one of those people, if they came back today, to life today, they would be astonished in our world, and they would all be, way to the right of David Duke on any issue you choose to be. I mean, every one of them. But...
Well, one of the motivations behind the abolitionists wasn't so much a moral opposition to slavery, although that was much of it. Was they feared living with black people in
right.
the North. That's why in Illinois itself, the land of Lincoln, a black person had to post $1,000 bond to be unescorted. They could not sue in court. They could not serve on a jury.
Yep.
And if a black man was found in Illinois without a bond, he was subject to being flogged and being kicked out of the state.
Right. I mean,
the North. That was the enlightened North.
Yeah, and Lincoln, like most of the people then, was for colonization. They wanted to basically colonize blacks back to Africa, and that was the prevailing opinion at their time. But we just, there's kind of a grudging acknowledgement of that here or there, but it's nothing is looked at in the context. Instead, in context of the times, instead, we look, from 2016, and we don't understand, why the South didn't, they weren't sympathetic to transgender rights. I mean, that's how absurd we get. You have to understand, a culture has changed and shifted so dramatically. Understand what it was like back then. Okay, yes, it's horrible that there were human beings that were enslaved and that went through that. None of us today should believe in slavery, except apparently the 30 million people that own slaves today. And I can't stress that enough, and there is no answer for it. Because the same people that want to still make movies about the Civil War and try to incite, hostility in blacks today as if, this is something that was never overcome, or it's the exact same way today as it was in 1865, that kind of stuff. And yet, no one focuses on the 10 million slaves in India and the 30 million slaves. How is there a slave anywhere in the world today? Especially when we lecture constantly about how awful the South was to have slaves, as if they were the only people that ever had slaves in the history of the world. And we know that slavery was an unfortunate and incomprehensible norm all over the world for a very long time. And it's... we don't understand that today, but bleeding patients with leeches is normal. There's lots of things we don't understand,
yeah.
And that's just the way the world was. And you can't You can't, you know, we're going to demonize all the doctors, the blood, you know, patients with leeches. I mean, that's, you just can't, you can't, you know, do that and be honest. But unfortunately, what we have today is just the social justice warrior mentality.
Well, I mean, up until the 1830s, there were more abolitionist societies in the South than there were in the North. What happened, you had the Nat Turner Rebellion and the situation in Haiti, and also you had this, well, people stirring up trouble in the North, like people like Henry Ward Beecher and Beecher's Bibles. He was literally sending in guns stored as Bibles into these, like Bleeding Kansas and into the South, stirring up a slave rebellion. Naturally, the South was going to react to that, and of course the first victim of that would be the legitimate, you know, abolitionist movements in the South and people that wanted to improve conditions of, for blacks in the South, and the South would close ranks. They would react.
Right.
So,
I'm sorry. And obviously, this is just such a controversial topic, and it's ridiculous that it should still be controversial 150 years later. But it is. It's something, especially when white people try to talk about it.
Well, I think the emphasis of slavery in the Civil War was probably for contemporary political reasons, because it really became the dominant issue in the 1960s. That coincided with the Civil Rights Movement.
Right.
And the interest behind that, again, that's another thing where there were sub-rosa interests behind the Civil Rights Movement that had very little to do with the welfare of blacks. It had much
right, and, that,
divide,
and that's,
divide
that's
and
exactly, and, that, and yeah. That's the only way that the North, under Lincoln and generals like Sherman and Sheridan, can possibly be portrayed sympathetically, is if you believe that somehow they were fighting to free the slaves. I don't believe they were. Their words show that they didn't believe they were. I mean, I believe it was Grant that said, you know, I would stop fighting right now if I thought I was fighting free slaves. And it just wasn't true, but you have to battle just like, it's just like today trying to fight CNN or MSNBC or Fox News. You're trying to battle those court historians about these issues, you just can't do it because, you know, C-SPAN...
Well, now Lincoln's now fighting vampires, so...
Yeah, exactly. How can you, you know, an incredibly muscular great vampire hunter?
Yeah, someone told me that when that came out, the Lincoln Vampire Slayer. And I said, well, that's about as accurate as any of most things I hear about Abraham Lincoln in history, so I don't mind that at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not too much more unreal than his, you know, his walking all the however different miles he did to return 3 cents or some stupid thing he supposedly did or refusing to... Or being undercharged by a prostitute or something. It's ridiculous stories. Of, okay. I don't know what they're supposed to be portraying, but Honest Abe, I think there's some evidence that the nickname Honest Abe was, devised the same way you'd call a bald guy curly, you know.
For
attribute he didn't have. But you're not going to get that from the court historians. But,
it was irony, yes. It wasn't...
So. Yeah, but so we, you know, and it's, I cover that quite a bit, and then we go up to, and you know, once America had bought into the concept of total war, and you know, eventually then, you know, we started taking, we keep crossing these, what I call moral lines in the sand. I think we crossed a bunch of them during the Civil War with the way that war was conducted. I think we crossed another one with the Spanish-American War of 1898, because that was the first war where we really expanded outside our own boundaries. We really violated all the precepts of George Washington's farewell address, and you know, where we were not supposed to have entangling alliances with other nations, or wanted peaceful relations with all. We're not supposed to get involved in the affairs of other nations. Where John Quincy Adams had said, you know, America does not go abroad to foreign monsters to conquer, whatever, to destroy. I mean, just imagine something that contradicts American foreign policy more than that statement did. But once we did that, once we set to that, and we got the first really imperialist in the White House, and Teddy Roosevelt, who really, and I go over Roosevelt's, right? There's another guy that was made some incredibly racist comments, left way more, I mean, you can't find really nothing on the record from Thomas Jefferson to compare with Abraham Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt, either one of them. Teddy Roosevelt, incredibly racist comments, not just about blacks, but about Indians, immigrants, and so forth. And but this guy was an incredible imperialist. He never met a war he didn't like. With Teddy Roosevelt was born the new pro-war mentality. And in some degrees, it's been in almost every White House since then. I mean, he wanted to go, at an advanced age, he tried to get Woodrow Wilson to let him go take a platoon into World War One, and Wilson didn't let him. But I'm,
and he, it was his, he was brought in to run against Taft in 1912 as, under the Bull Moose Party, so they could get Wilson in, into the White House to secure, well, the creation of the Federal Reserve and also perhaps even America's entry in, into the Great War, which looked like it was being planned.
That whole era just shows how dishonestly all these things are portrayed by the court historians, because if we look back at that era, the ones pushing for war constantly were the Teddy Roosevelts, the Woodrow Wilsons of the world, the liberals like Clarence Darrow, those kind of, they were pushing for war, again, and not even, no one can call World War I a good war. I mean, I one of the greatest things Benjamin Franklin ever said, one of his forgotten comments, was there's never been such a thing as a good war or a bad peace. And Americans seem to have forgotten that completely, but no one calls World War I a good war. No one seems to know what caused it, but looking back in retrospect, it was the liberals of the day, the so-called liberals of the day, like Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, who was, I mean, look at this guy's record and how he is portrayed as a progressive. There's nothing progressive about him at all. He was pro-war, pro-imperialist, a virulent racist against all groups other than whites. But he's remembered very fondly by the court historians, and so is Wilson. And Wilson is kind of equated as, well, you know, he had a dream of the League of Nations. He wanted world peace. He was pushing us constantly into World War One. He was a pawn. Not only that, he oversaw the creation of the Federal Reserve. But meanwhile, you have William Jennings Bryan, who ran for president, who resigned from Wilson's, I believe it was Secretary of State, resigned from Wilson's administration in protest over World War One because he was a genuine liberal, real liberal, who recognized the absurdity of getting into a European war. How is he remembered today? He's remembered as a cranky guy that died shortly after the Scopes Monkey Trial against the great liberal hero Clarence Darrow. Again, Clarence Darrow was an incredible eugenicist. He, as I said, was pro-war all the way, yet he's remembered as a great liberal.
Yeah, and Jennings won that case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this forgetting, but Jennings supposedly, when Hollywood made the movie years later with Spencer Tracy and so forth, he's portrayed as this Bible-thumping fool, when in reality, Jennings Bryan's opposition to evolution was based almost exclusively on his opposition to eugenics. Not on his interpretation of the Bible, but it's been completely twisted, because he did not believe, he recognized that evolution, very rightly, that Darwin's survival of the fittest and so forth would lead inevitably to, well, what happened in, you know, with Hitler and so forth, where the lesser beings need to be killed. You know, you have to have a survival, the strong, only the strong survive. No need for any, that's what eugenics is. But, you know, we already know Margaret Sanger, the president of Planned Parenthood. I mean, she, talk about a racist. she was caught writing a letter saying, you know, what we really, if we succeed or something, we will wipe the entire black race out.
Yeah, like, it was that.
And she's a liberal icon. Hillary Clinton's hero. This is how history is. Meanwhile, Henry Ford, a genuine pacifist, who tried to start a peace ship with his own money. He wanted an international peace ship where he was getting all the world leaders together to try to come to terms and avoid this tremendous bloodshed. He's remembered as an anti-Semite because he later wrote The International Jew and passed out a bunch of anti-Semitic literature in his plans. But regardless of that, he was a genuine pacifist, and what he tried to do in World War One is admirable. But he's remembered, you know, everybody just kind of rolls their eyes, oh, yeah, he hated Jews. And
well, yeah, but
Woodrow Wilson is remembered as a great guy, Theodore Roosevelt.
If Ford vision had become a reality, the World War II wouldn't have happened, and all the killing and all the death, including all the Jews that died in that war, would have been spared. But the reality is there are certain factions that wanted that war, and Ford was probably being rather naive. It wasn't a question of, you know, people of goodwill getting together and solving the differences. The bankers wanted this war, the powder trust, the industries wanted this war.
Right.
And you know, they wanted the debt that would come from the war, the perpetual debt, and all the money. You mentioned, you know, the merchants of death, people like Bernard Baruch, and they carried off like $40 billion of wealth from that war, and of course one of the World War II itself, because one of the reasons why America got into the First World War was the Balfour Declaration, which was a deal between Zionists and the Zionists in D.C. who put pressure on Wilson. And so, but if America hadn't gotten into that war, Germany would not have been defeated, and Hitler never would have come to power.
Exactly, and like they said, the Treaty of Versailles made it inevitable that Hitler, and everybody knows, there was a book called Born at Versailles, and that's Hitler was born at Versailles, and everybody understood it. And Herbert Hoover was a bit more enlightened than somebody. He was the only person, American representative, that went to Versailles that tried to counsel. Hey, this is wrong. You know, this, what you're doing here, you're setting the stage for another war. And Hoover, I mean, I'm not saying it was great, but he comes off much better in the light of history than a lot of
people. He does, And same, he wrote the book Freed and Betrayed, which was published posthumously.
Yes.
And he was all about Pearl Harbor, and he was the one that was very skeptical. Yes. The same thing occurred with the Japanese, because you mentioned earlier the Spanish-American War. That was America's entry into sort of this blue water navy and empire into
the Pacific.
Remember the Maine? Yeah, remember the Maine. A false flag event. But they
thinking of Louisitanian World War One.
But it was America that went into, I think, in as early as the 1850s with Commodore Perry showing up with his gunboats in Tokyo Bay.
That's why Smedley Butler is so important. I talk so much about General Smedley Butler, who wrote War is a Racket, and he's got so many great quotes in there. But it essentially boils down. I mean, he talked about all the money he made for United Fruit and all the stuff. He realized what he was doing in all these countries where we were already starting again. We crossed those lines, you know, during that era, in the World War I-ish era afterwards, where we started going into all these countries, the Latin American countries, these smaller countries, and we started exploiting them. And his great quote was, a war is not about enemies, it's about opportunities for profit.
Mm-hmm. And I was a collector and muscle for Brown Brothers Harriman and the White Shoe Boys of Wall Street. And that kind of spells out what's really going on behind all these wars. It really is. It's the sort of the – he spelled out, well, I guess what John Perkins would later call the economic hitman model. But going in and pretty much, whether using the Marines, now it's more NGOs and stuff. The tactics have changed with the times, but they go in there and they saddle the country with debt, and the collateral is the country's literally the blood, sweat, and tears of the people and the natural resources of the targeted country, and you destabilize
People like Smedley Butler, again, are forgotten by history. These are the genuine liberals, that they're the real liberals, the classical liberals, not the Woodrow Wilsons and later the Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You have the Smedley Butlers, the Huey Longs of the day, who were genuinely concerned about the welfare of the people, or Robert Taft later on the side, Bob LaFollette. I mean, I talk about Taft in there, and he was, screwed out of the nomination by Eisenhower.
I like his remarks. He says, every president's been, since 1936, been elected by National City Bank or Chase Bank.
Yeah, Chase Manhattan.
Chase Manhattan Bank.
Exactly. He's exactly right. And they don't make Democrats like Huey Long anymore, and they don't make Republicans like Robert Taft anymore. And that's the problem that we have, is that we used to have more good people in her spread. Of course, unfortunately, they were always stopped, even then. Huey Long was assassinated, Smedley Butler was forgotten, and I've still tried to find out. He died at a pretty young age, and I really can't find out much detail about why he died, but he's pretty much been forgotten by history. He's a hero of mine, and he talked again about how it was all about making money, and he wrote beautifully about, he's got some eloquent stuff he wrote about World War One, where, all the new millionaires that were created, all the money that was made, and how they exploited the boys, and we've had this cardboard character Uncle Sam figure, this really hideous, talk about a figure that the founding fathers would have been mortified over. I mean, they sold this Uncle Sam character, wants you to represent the government, and somehow that generation, to their everlasting shame, bought it. Hook, line, and sinker, and Johnny Comes Marching Home, and the Doughboys, and Johnny Gets Your Gun, and all Hollywood got in on it, and George M. Cohan, and all these fake patriot stuff, where it really became popular then to be a patriot. And then World War II, it went into overdrive. I mean, you had Bugs Bunny selling bonds, and everyone from Tarzan to the Three Stooges fighting the Nazis, and it was just unbelievably overwhelming. And I have
Disney,
a lot of that.
Disney was taken over by the War Department.
Yeah, and Disney, his thanks for that is to be remembered by the court historians as some kind of anti-Semite when he did everything he could to fight the Nazis along with the rest of Hollywood. But that's the way they come up with these they come up with these labels for people, and they develop these narratives, and until one of them somehow nibbles away at it and creates a new alternative to the narrative, that's what it becomes. And you can't break through those official stories. You can't get tenured at any of these colleges if you don't buy along to it. If you don't tell them what they want to hear, they don't care about evidence. Evidence. You know, that's not something to say. They know. You know, everybody knows that. Well, what do you mean? And that's where you try to talk to these people, and that's what you get. And Thomas DiLorenzo, you know, certainly found out about that with Lincoln, and John Tolan found out about it after this guy was a Pulitzer Prize winning court historian par excellence until he wrote Infamy, which was a great, thoroughly documented research of the events leading up to Pearl Harbor, and it showed conclusively that Franklin Roosevelt had foreknowledge. There's no doubt, it can be no doubt in anybody's mind just reading his book and the evidence he unearthed.
Yeah, you have also subsequent works of Dave Deceit by Stennett.
Stennett again. Yeah. He came under fire, even though he was actually defending it and saying Roosevelt should have done it. But he still came under tremendous attack, and everybody poo-poos it and says it's a conspiracy theory. And Tolan was drummed out of the court historian circle after that. He was called a Nazi by Barbara Tuchman, his fellow court historian. And he ended his days, you know, very lonely figure, just speaking at Institute for Historical Review events, because those are the only people that would have him.
The only place. That's the only place you can go to get some sort of revisionist account of these things. IHR,
right? That's what happens. And you get called anti-Semitic and racist and everything else. And
something happened with Joe Sobrin.
Yes, Joe Sobrin too. Yes, Sobrin. I mean, and that's what happens if people. Once an historian becomes awake, now thank goodness now today there are publishers like mine, and Tom DiLorenzo has obviously found publishers, that where you can get these, they're not going to get on television. The court historians are going to smear them, or they're going to ignore them for the most part. If they have to acknowledge them, it's going to be to criticize them and blast them and just dismiss them, very arrogantly. But at least there's a little bit... more of an avenue now for people to get that out there. And, people like me, I'm used to being called names. People can't quite figure me out because I'm pretty leftist on most issues. But, I don't look at it. I'm a populist, and I believe in power of the people, and I believe in truth, and I believe in historical truth. And, it doesn't matter if it doesn't have to fit an agenda. But for the court historians, they have to have an agenda because they can't have something even that happened 200 years ago, if it contradicts whatever official reality they're pushing today. And that's why you see them trying to fit everything from the past into today's social constructs.
Yeah, well, the Lincoln myth, the myth of FDR, these things are the foundation for the modern state today. So if you if you shatter those icons are holding up the structure of the modern imperial of imperial America. The interventionism, good as America must intervene because of Hitler all the time. Anyone who questions an intervention or bombing somewhere, you invite a comparison to Neville Chamberlain in Munich. They never want to debate Munich, the merits of Munich, or or what really went on.
Caesar, he was on the wrong side. I mean, that's the whole thing. The America First Committee was made up almost exclusively of far left people. You had people that were sympathetic to it, like Sinclair Lewis and Eugene Debs, mm-hmm. who were socialists. John T. Flynn, who I talk a lot about, there was a very well known liberal newspaper man, and his career was destroyed. Just because he was a part of that, Charles Lindbergh.
Yeah, he wrote As We Go Marching, a classic.
Yeah.
That time, yeah.
It's amazing to me that there was no dissent allowed, and that's why you talk about things. When I talk about the Civil War, so many things we never recovered from there, as far as the conduct of the war, and the way people were thrown into jail for no reason at all. Suspension of writ of habeas corpus, and that was never, no one was ever punished for that. We barely even acknowledge it. And we just attributed to, well, it was extraordinary circumstances. Lincoln had to do it to save the Union. And then later in World War II, we don't talk about literally, on World War I, there was much more dissent. Lots of people were thrown into jail, and then they revived the Alien and Sedition Acts, which had been unpopular under John Adams, that, you know, when Jefferson took office, you know, he got rid of them and he rightly criticized them. But later under World War I, they were, again, the great liberal Woodrow Wilson revived them, and people like socialist Eugene Debs went to prison. Lots of people went to prison.
That's right. But if you opposed the war, it wasn't the Kaiser putting you in jail, it was your president.
Exactly, exactly.
So what are you fighting for?
And in World War II, I think Americans had learned by then, they had become, so, and they really, that, you know, that so-called greatest generation paved the way for, you know, way for my generation, the baby boomer generation, which has been awful.
I think by then they had been gone through so many shocks, World War One, the Great Depression, and of course during the Great Depression, many men were mobilized under these alphabet soup agents like the Civilian Conservation Corps, which got them ready, prepared psychologically for boot camp. So when they were drafted in 1940 in peacetime, they just accepted it. Not to mention all the movies coming out at the time, you know, Sergeant York and Gunga Din, praising the British Empire. British had taken over much of Hollywood.
Pro-British
movies. So they were
glorified.
So they were being conditioned. So the generation that went off to fight the good war was more than willing to go off and fight the forgotten war, you know, grudgingly, but they did it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. But by that time, I think the greatest generation, so-called, it's unbelievable if you look back at that era, there was so little rebellion, or there was no opposition to it. It was, I mean, people planted victory gardens. They trusted Uncle Sam. They bought bonds. They, you know, they had air raids and blackouts and rationing and all. And they accepted it all when they apparently lost all their critical ability to think. They didn't think for a second that they were siding with monsters at least as big as the ones they were fighting. I mean, it's. I don't think anyone can debate that Uncle Joe Stalin, you know, was at least as bad as Hitler.
Yeah, I think it was in John T. Flynn's As We Go Marching. Mm-hmm. He highlights, as Americans were suffering with ration cards during the war, that people high up in the Roosevelt administration were throwing themselves lavish parties at taxpayers' expenses.
Yeah, well, and Huey, I have lots of quotes. Well, yeah. I probably have more of those. I have a whole chapter devoted to Huey Long and Survival of the Richest, which is coming out next year, and he is my political hero. But he just did. I think I have some more quotes in this book too. But lots of things about that, about, you know, Roosevelt spending too much time on his yacht. He was great for coming up with names. I forget the name of Roosevelt's yacht, but Huey came up with a kind of great denigrating name about, you know, reflecting how much time he was spending on his yacht. And he talked constantly about all the bankers around Roosevelt and lots of the other real, you know, liberals of his day talked about, you know, how disappointing it was because Roosevelt got in there and it was nothing but the same old names around him, the Bernard Baruchs.
He was not a traitor to his class despite that claim.
Court historians want you to think that, and he didn't. The only reason the Depression ever came under control at all was because of World War II, and then the boom afterwards, you know, with the growth of the military-industrial complex, and, of course, the trade-off for people like myself later, born in 1956, was that I had a childhood like none other than Americans had ever experienced, because we were living in the last days of that post-war boom, but life economically was better than it ever had been for every American, so... You know, but it's a selfish trade-off.
Well, short-lived. It's guns and butter because we saw the 70s, and it's been up and down since then. And
yeah, I mean, since then, we're understanding now just how unique that time period, the 50s, basically the late 40s up until the early 60s was.
And it wasn't sustainable because it was all based on, well, the Bretton Woods system and the inflated dollar. Of course, that's why it collapsed in 71, and you've had the petrodollar, of course, I'd argue the narco-dollar since then, which is all based on, well, parasitism, and, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's not sustainable in the sense. You can get a good life from hard work and genuine growth, or you can get it through this current system.
And, right, and that's, you know, that's it, right. It's basically built on a house of cards and, And now everyone's seeing exactly how without that boom, you know, to build it, and without the dot-com boom that nobody foresaw in the 90s that kind of kept it artificially afloat a little bit
longer. Yeah, everyone's looking for the next bubble. How about, like, sustained day-to-day growth? You know, how,
right, exactly. Well, that would, again, take sacrifice from the people that never sacrifice, the ones at the top.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we talked about the world wars and the shocks that were felt, and you mentioned, I believe in your book, you bring up the Cold War and the Rees Committee and their findings. Is this when you get the real evidence of, say, sort of an elitist conspiracy to
oh my gosh, look what my quote in there that they discovered the quote from the Carnegie Institute for International Peace. Mm-hmm. Talk about an institution that was inappropriately named. And they talk again about how they were advocating for war before World War One, and these things about how, I mean, I don't have the exact quotes in front of me that you might, but about how that was basically how can we drag the war out? How can we? This is the Carnegie Institute for International Peace, and later, I don't have the.
Well, I think what happened was that Norman Dodd was the chief investigator.
Yes, Norman Dodd. Yes.
Carol Rees Committee. Yeah. They're investigating the foundations.
Norman Dodd was the name guy. He was the one that wrote the report later, and I quote extensively from that. And he talks about his secretary, I believe, was
Catherine Casey.
Catherine Casey, yeah. Who I tried to find out what happened to her family. You know, the Casey.
She had a nervous breakdown or something.
Because she was. Like most of the committee, they just kind of, you know, didn't believe, well, why are you attacking these foundations? They're doing good work and everything. And he uncovered a lot of real dirt behind them. And Catherine Casey went and looked at these things. And like you said, she was so shocked and so traumatized by it that she suffered a breakdown, left. I believe she ended up getting a government job somewhere far away from it through her connections to Carol Rees or something. Mm-hmm. But Norman Dodd, you know, he just talks a little bit about it, but I would love to know, you know, really exactly what happened to her. But that's, again, one of these victims, you know. They almost die. Their lives get destroyed.
Norman Dodd's very interesting because I believe in the interview with G. Edward Griffin,
as a
young man in the late 20s or 30s, he was employed by a bank up in New York, and he was put in charge of a study committee how to deal with banking reform. Mm-hmm. And he came up with a plan that would stabilize the banking system. Basically, it would mean full reserve banking, non-fractional reserve banking. And mm-hmm. it was rejected outright by the bankers because the bankers wanted an unstable banking system.
Oh, yeah. They can't. They
want booms and busts, which brings me to this quote, which I believe, I don't know if I read this in your book or it's Charles Lindbergh Sr.
During the Federal Reserve, yeah.
Yeah, he said, a new law will create inflation whenever the trusts want inflation. From now on, depressions will be scientifically created.
Yep.
And, events have seemed to borne his warning.
Oh, yeah. And people, again, the Federal Reserve, criticism of the Federal Reserve is almost the exclusive province of conspiracy theorists. So it's spread out a little bit now to where, you know, even Bernie Sanders and Trump, you know, can talk a little bit about it, but nobody touches on the nature of the system itself. And Henry Ford, going back to him again, he's the one that came up with that great quote: "If the American people understood our banking system, there'd be a revolution tomorrow." And I don't really accept that because I think at this point they're so dumbed down that first of all, to make them understand it, because I've tried to explain it to people, and it really is impossible.
Well, I tell people it's a bank. Doesn't loan money it has. It creates money to make the loan, then they charge interest on it.
Yeah,
why,
I mean, it's,
why it's, can't it's, I do that?
Yeah, I mean, what is the difference between that and any counterfeiting that goes on? Yeah. People are sent to prison for counterfeiting. It's the exact same thing.
If I was given the power to create $1 billion, I'd be a billionaire overnight.
Exactly. Well, just imagine, you know, one of your friends wants to borrow $100. Well, you can just write him a check for $100, even though you only have $10 in the bank. And where does that $90 come from? And where does the interest come from that you're going to charge him on it? So 90% of the principal on these fractional loans are not there. They're created out of nothing, and 100% of the interest. So they couldn't be called in if they tried. There's not enough money out there, and it's obviously an impossible situation. It's about as wrong as anything could ever be, because it is legalized counterfeiting. And that's why I say anybody that ends up not being able to pay their mortgage, or any of the credit card loans where they'll charge you like 30% interest or whatever. I mean, I'm always on the side. I mean, old-fashioned people say, well, you got to pay your debts. And I try to explain to them, yeah, but these debts are corrupt. They're not real debts. It's not. Yes, if you borrow $100 from a friend or a family member, yeah, then you should pay them back.
They're out that $100, yeah.
Yeah, they're out that $100, and they helped you, gave you a helping hand. But you go to a mortgage company, a bank, they're not giving you your neighbors or your fellow depositors' money. That's not the way it works. They only have to have a fraction. Ron Paul, I think, has gone on the record, and he believes it's not even 10% anymore in most cases.
No. I mean, it's just like when during the 08 crisis, the Fed, I think, gave out $16 to $27 trillion, and Congress said, where did it go? And so, oh, we can't tell you that. There's no oversight. There's no oversight.
If you remember back in the 90s, I think, there was a brief movement just to try to rein in credit card interest rates.
Yeah.
Just to put like a cap of 10%. And you would have thought the entire wrath of the establishment came down on these few congressmen that were actually wanting to honestly reform something, and it went away so quickly.
Well, when they constantly devalue the currency, debase the currency, they're willing to come back and offer you cheap credit, which means debt. So debt is the other side of monetary debasement. So when they're constantly debasing the money supply to pay off the debt, see the vicious cycle it creates? So you're forcing people to either to maintain their lifestyle or to continue consuming, to go into debt because their wages are being the value of their wages are being devalued by the monetary debasement, which is needed to maintain the debt cycle. But someone's collecting.
Well, that was Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah,
and that
so it's a cycle. But the point is, they wouldn't inflate unless someone's getting the money first. So obviously, the corporations. The big financial houses, the corporations, they're getting the easy money, and with the easy money, they're buying up assets and they're concentrating the economy, which is why Staples and Walmart, these big corporate chains are dominating the economy now, destroying the local businesses, the mom and pop shops, because they don't get the easy access credit, nor do they get the tax breaks.
Exactly, and that's more and more people are seeing through this, but. It's those of us like who really study history. It's we're dealing with if we think it's hard to wake people up to the events of going on now, mm-hmm. and it is, it's almost impossible to wake people up to the events of history because as I said before, I mean Americans are by and large historically illiterate. If you watch those videos online of Mark Dice and people like that talk to people in San Diego is a affluent area, you'd think that they would be by more educated than most parts of the country. They are as dumb as rocks. I mean, they don't know anything of the simplest questions about, why do we celebrate Independence Day? They literally don't know what we're celebrating on the 4th of July. And I think they don't even have an understanding of history. They don't even understand the official narratives. So to try to get them to know the official narratives are wrong, first you have to teach them what the official – I mean, you can't even – it's like deprogramming a Mooney from the old days back in the Unification Church. I mean, you got to deprogram them. They're just it's amazing. You have to start from scratch. So trying to get most people to – I mean, thankfully, there are still lots of people out there that are interested and thirsty for history and understand how important history is. As Santayana said, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. And then, of course, Orwell's great line, he who controls the past – who is it? He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. And – That's so important for us to remember is that he who controls the corrupt leaders we have right now through their court historians and mainstream media control the past. And if we don't understand what really went on during a momentous event like the Civil War or Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, the assassinations of the 60s and so forth, if we're lied, 9/11, if we're lied to about all these events, and I believe very strongly we have been lied to about all these events, then we can't hope to find the right solutions. It's like trying to do a math equation. If you get something, if you're writing all those numbers on the board and one of the numbers in the middle, just one, is wrong, let alone almost all of them being wrong, you're never going to get the right equation. It's impossible to get the right answer.
Exactly. Well, Donald, the book, Hidden History 2, Pre-1963 Corruption, Conspiracies and Cover-Ups. Well, I have the manuscript, and the edit, and your publisher has it.
So well, actually, the publisher doesn't even have it yet, because he still got the book about Boeing. Yeah, so I'm trying to – they move slowly, but thank goodness they're willing to publish me, because it's the problem is most publishers aren't, but the publishing world just kind of moves a lot slower than those of us who write a lot would like them to.
And, of course, that is a sequel prequel, to Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. You can get that book right now at, I guess, Amazon or your website?
Yeah, and a new paperback of that is out with a new foreword by Roger Stone.
Oh, okay.
It has blurbs by Cindy Sheehan, former Representative Cynthia McKinney, Lou Rockwell just called it one of the most extraordinary books he's ever read. So the left and the right, people on the left and the right both can appreciate it, and that really makes me happy because I don't believe in the left-right paradigm. So I'm really happy to see both extremes liking it.
Yeah, at the very least, don't have an allergic reaction because something utters a leftist-sounding idea or something. You should listen to the argument and you realize that these things are actually much more complex and layered. So I know we've been trained to choose right or left, team red, team blue, and not to listen to each other. And that's all part of the dialectic being created for us by the oligarchs. Your soon-to-be-released book is, what, July this year, next summer? Survival
July
of Riches? 4th,
supposedly July 4th, just in time for your fireworks.
Okay. Survival of the Riches?
Survival of the Riches, yeah.
Okay, and great. And your website, of course, is...
DonaldJeffries.wordpress.com. I think the blog is called Keeping It Unreal, and you can keep up with my latest rants and commentaries on there.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I think tonight we gave the listener a flavor of what they might find in this book whenever it comes out. I thought when I heard you on Lou Rockwell's show, I thought I'd send you a note because I wanted to talk to you about it because I was so impressed with the first one. And I thought some of these issues that you bring up in the book, the pre-1963 conspiracies and crimes and these things, I thought are an important thing to educate people on. It didn't begin with Kennedy getting shot in Dallas. It's been a long haul.
It's been a
gradual thing. And it's, I guess, one of the things, I guess it's just the maybe it's just the human condition. These things exist in every society, and we'll never have a utopia. But nevertheless, it's important to bring these things up and educate the people as much as possible, so we don't repeat the past.
That's right. Sure, that's for sure.
Great. Well, listen. Thanks a lot, and have a good night.
Thank you, Sam, for having me.
Good night, Ben. Bye bye.
Good night.